From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Some people will hear music and it causes them to see colors. And other people will hear a name and it will put a taste in their mouth. Other people, they'll taste something and it will make them feel like there's something being felt on their fingertips.
These are all synesthetes, people whose brains are wired for unusual cross-sensory experiences. In fact, the brain has all sorts of strategies for enhancing perception. Today, we'll talk about various ways of seeing, or in some cases, not seeing.
I'm re-examining myself. Am I blind? Am I sighted? How blind am I? What do I have to do to be competent? And I have to deal all the time with that issue of competence, how to do things when I no longer see very well.
Also, the remarkable story of the painter Chuck Close, who struggled with various neurological disorders and a spinal artery collapse that nearly killed him. But Close doesn't mind problems. As an artist, he welcomes them.
I think that we're way too involved in problem solving. Problem creation is a much more interesting thing to spend your energy on. If you can ask yourself an interesting enough question, no one else's answers will fit.
But first, we turn to Oliver Sacks, the celebrated doctor who writes about some of the brain's strangest disorders. His many books include Awakenings, The Island of the Colorblind, and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. His latest book, The Mind's Eye, is a study of rare visual impairments caused by neurological disorders. It's an unusually personal book for Sacks because it reveals his own struggle with a disorder called facial blindness. Steve Paulson sat down with Sacks recently to talk about some case histories.
You start your book with the story of a woman who lost her ability to read music and then much else as well. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, this was a fine concert pianist. To her great surprise, when there was a sudden switch in a concert from one Mozart piano concerto to another, and she wanted to just take a glance at the score, she found it unintelligible. She saw the notes, the clefs, the markings, but none of it conveyed any meaning for her. Later, this problem extended to reading ordinary print, although she could still write perfectly well.
And she could still play the piano.
And she could still play the piano and very beautifully, continue to give concerts and to teach, although now she could not increase her repertoire by reading scores. She had to do everything by ear.
So neurologically, what was going on?
Well, she seemed to have a slowly progressive problem, which started with music, spread to print, and from there to all sorts of common objects and people and faces which she could no longer recognize, but all of which she saw perfectly clearly. So neurologists call this an agnosia. These are percepts which have been stripped of meaning, and agnosias go with damage to part of the visual cortex at the back of the brain. They may come on suddenly with a head injury or a stroke, or slowly because people have a degenerative brain disease, as Lillian had.
So her eyes were perfectly fine. Her vision was fine, but it was her brain could not make sense of what she was looking at.
Yes, absolutely. And in her first letter to me, she commented that she could see the smallest letters on the eye chart, but nonetheless couldn't make sense of them.
So how did she compensate? How did she manage to get through her daily routines?
Well, I was very puzzled when I saw her and tested her in the clinic. I couldn't imagine how. And so I made a house call, as I like to do. I think it's very important to see people in their own surroundings. And I found that she had really reorganized everything in the apartment by color, by size, by position, by association. She developed a system for finding her way around and identifying objects, although none of them were identified in the usual way.
Now, you tell another story of a different patient who lost his ability to read after a stroke, actually a writer, and somehow managed to continue to write but could no longer read. Can you tell me about him?
Well, with him it was quite sudden. He came down one morning, had breakfast, had no intimation of anything the matter, but then went outside to get his daily paper, which at a distance looked normal, but when he looked closer, seemed to be full of some unintelligible, peculiar-looking script, which he said was like Korean or Cyrillic or Serbo-Croat. And like the first patient, like Lillian, he found he could write perfectly well, although he couldn't read what he had written. And initially, he was in despair about this. He thought it would be the end of him as a creative writer. He could write, but he wouldn't be able to revise or reread what he'd written. But then, to his own surprise and bewilderment, reading started to become easier. And at first he thought this was due to neurological recovery, to healing. But then it became apparent that some new mechanisms or strategies were operating for him. And inadvertently, he would often copy what his eye saw with his finger, and in this way, as it were, turn what he saw into writing, into finger writing, and then this moved up to his tongue, and so he would copy what he was reading on the back of his teeth or the roof of his mouth, and basically this way he was reading by writing with his tongue. This was not something which he consciously devised, but it happened, and I think it's an example of the extraordinary sort of ingenuity the nervous system often provides.
That's astonishing, the story of somehow maintaining this ability to read with the help of your tongue.
I mean, he did mention to me, this was a letter I got just a few months ago, that he'd bitten the end of his tongue accidentally, and it was so sore he couldn't move it, and that he had become functionally illiterate while the tongue was out of action.
Now, you seem to be particularly interested in these cases of people with rare visual impairments and the ways they've learned to compensate for their difficulties. Why are you so interested in sort of this connection between the brain and how we see?
Well, we take seeing for granted. We think that we're given the world full of color and movement and texture and meaning. And I think one would have no idea of how this all worked were it not for strange disorders which can suddenly make reading impossible or suddenly make one totally colorblind or totally unable to perceive movement. Sometimes it can occur briefly with a migraine. I once had it myself for 5 minutes with a migraine, and I couldn't read the street signs. I thought they were in Phoenician. And sometimes, even as a child, I would find that half the world disappeared or lost its color. And so I had a very precocious introduction to how necessary the brain was for seeing.
And you write about how you've had some of your own visual challenges. For instance, you have a great deal of difficulty recognizing other people's faces.
Yes, this has been lifelong, and it's caused offense and embarrassment and bewilderment. And I would have to apologize to people every day for cutting them, or I thought I was, I think, inattentive or careless. And it was only later that I began to realize, especially when I met an older brother whom I hadn't seen for decades and he had exactly the same problem, that this might be some odd family thing. And if we had it in our family, it might be common elsewhere. And when My Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat book came out in 86, I received, in fact, I continue to receive, dozens of letters from people who spoke of lifelong difficulties recognizing faces.
And it turns out this is actually a surprisingly common problem, this face blindness. I mean, aren't there estimates that it's something like 2% of the population has some form of face blindness?
Yes, absolutely. And this estimate is based on large samples. Some of it pretty mild, and people are hardly aware of it unless they're specially tested, but sometimes so severe that they don't recognize their husbands or wives or children, or for that matter, themselves.
So what causes this?
Well, this again is part of the what's called the visual association cortex, part of the visual system being knocked out or failing to develop. Again, I think it wouldn't occur to one that there was a special system for recognizing faces, if it were not for this extraordinary specific business of face blindness. But here, unlike reading, which is only a redeployment of systems developed long ago by evolution, I think there's much evidence to suggest that face recognition appeared in monkeys about 25 or 30 million years ago, perhaps also with full color vision, because at that point monkeys became barefaced, they lost their hair, and it became crucially important to recognize faces and see what their emotions were. And so we all have to become expert at face recognition.
It makes me wonder if my dog can recognize my face. I guess I've always assumed he can, but maybe I should not assume that. Maybe he recognizes me through other means.
Well, it may be by your movement or your shape or your sound or your smell, in somewhat the same way as face-blind people find other ways of recognizing human beings.
So has this been a big part of your life? I mean, sort of this inability to recognize other people? Have you constructed your life in ways to compensate?
Well, I think I've probably done so automatically without much thought, but it's probably contributed to my avoiding large gatherings and usually having someone with me who will act as a recognizer.
Have you found yourself relying on other senses more acutely because you have certain visual impairments?
I think so, but also on other aspects of visual sense. I think I'm extremely sensitive to visual movement and motor style and posture, the way people walk, the way they hold their limbs. I often pay conscious attention to the way they dress, but the voices is quite crucial. Again and again, I don't recognize someone until they speak, and then the first syllable lets me recognize them. I have to say, although I don't usually make too much of a point of this, that I have a very keen nose, and sometimes there are various people I recognize by smell.
Really? What do you smell in them? Do people have different scents, a sort of a personal smell?
Absolutely. I mean, ask any dog. I feel a little bit like a dog this way.
And you say that, in fact, there are times when you look in the mirror and you don't actually realize that it's you you're looking at.
Yeah, it tends to occur in unexpected context when I suddenly feel I'm about to bump into a large man with a gray beard and I start to apologize and then realize it's a mirror or a shop window or something like this. And I've occasionally had the corollary of this, sort of sitting outside at a table in a restaurant and starting to comb my beard in the window and then realizing that my reflection isn't doing that. But there's a bearded man on the other side who wonders why I'm preening myself in front of him.
Oh, you seem to have a remarkable ability to laugh at these kinds of embarrassing situations.
I can laugh later, but some of them are not laughing matters initially. Although, again, laughter is one of one's adaptations. If one can laugh something off, then you will defuse offense.
The neurologist and best-selling writer, Oliver Sacks, he talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Mind's Eye. In a minute, the murky line between blindness and vision. And later this hour, artist Chuck Close talks about his own disability.
Sometimes when I roll by a mirror, I'm shocked to see that I'm in a wheelchair because I sit and look out at a world that's essentially unchanged. When people look at me, they see somebody who's disabled. But that's not really how I see myself.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
For the past decade, Susan Krieger's world has been slowly slipping into darkness. She's not completely blind, at least not yet, but her vision is bad enough to make her legally blind. And although she prizes her self-sufficiency, she recently got a guide dog, Tila, who is now her constant companion. Now, all of this raises some basic questions about how Susan Krieger thinks of herself, about her competence, her self-worth, and the fine line between light and darkness. Krieger writes about these questions in a collection of essays called Traveling Blind.
I have a kind of blindness to do with the autoimmune disease that has affected my eyes called birdshot retinochoroidopathy. This is an eye condition that I've had for about 14 years now that is caused by swelling and scarring on my retina and choroid, and that gives me blind spots in my central vision. I have blind spots on my peripheral vision also, and plenty of distortions and interferences with my vision. So I see somewhat, but I have many areas in which I don't see.
What strikes me is that in some ways, this is almost harder. And I don't know that it would be easier to be completely blind, because you can still see some things. But you're not always sure exactly what's there, are you?
Exactly. Life is a guessing game. Very often as I walk down the street, you know, traveling with my guide dog, and I'm looking around and I'm not sure, is something I see ahead, a dog or a child or a garbage can?
I know that one of the things that is a constant source of irritation for you, because you seem so confident, I guess, is that people will often see you walking with Tila, your guide dog, and ask if you're training her.
Yes. Very soon after I came home with my new guide dog several years ago, I found that frequently people would ask me this question, are you training that dog? And at first I thought, oh, I must be doing it wrong. Am I giving her the right signals, stopping at the curb properly? But it soon became evident to me that people, when they were asking about the dog, were really asking about me. And they looked at me and they thought, I don't know if she's sighted or if she's blind, because I think perhaps I didn't fit a stereotype. And so they would say, are you training that dog?
It's interesting, isn't it, that people feel as though they own that little piece of you because you're walking with a dog. They wouldn't stop me on the street and ask me if I was trying on a new pair of shoes, but they
right.
feel quite comfortable asking you. And I suppose because they do want to know. You don't wear dark glasses. You don't stare at the ground.
I do. Actually, it was happening to me even when I wore the dark glasses, because I tried to make it stop happening. So I wore dark glasses. I started to stare at the ground. I started to do more of the behaviors people expected of a blind person, which may have helped me sometimes. You know, I think many people are blind to a varying degree and walk around, but it's an invisible disability. When it becomes visible, which is what happens when you're guided by a guide dog, then some of these questions do come up. So I was aware that even though I try to fit the stereotypes, let's say by wearing dark glasses, or occasionally I try to stumble on purpose just to avoid the question, I still didn't fit the stereotypes in some ways, and people were curious. And a dog makes people friendly. They step forward. They try to interact.
Well, and that's, I think, the other interesting part of this. It is not only blindness that you have begun to examine. It's all aspects of personality. Because if this kind of thing, which is, you'd think, obvious enough, can raise questions, then you begin to think about other parts of your life, your relationships with other people, your history, the things you've decided to do. And it strikes me that that's part of what you're writing about, is that blindness is a physical manifestation of our relationship with the community around us.
Yes, I think so. That's a good point. It isn't in isolation. It isn't something that just happens in a medical sense with my eyes, for instance. As soon as it starts to happen, I'm reexamining myself. Am I blind? Am I sighted? How blind am I? How blind am I tomorrow as opposed to yesterday? What do I have to do to be competent? And I have to deal all the time with that issue of competence, you know, how to do things when I no longer see very well. And how to deal with other people when they have questions and when I must ask for assistance. For instance, I write about airport stories because we've had many adventures as we travel in airports that are unusual.
Well, give me an example, for instance. What happens when you and Tila go traveling by air?
Well, the very first time she and I went on an airline trip alone, I went up to the desk and I had reserved a bulkhead seat so that she'd have room to lie on the floor at my feet. And the person behind the counter at the airline said to me, "I can't let you have that seat." And I thought, but I reserved it. And she said, "A person sitting in that seat needs to be able to read and follow directions and help other persons in the case of an emergency." Now, I thought, well, I can't read that print, but someone could read it to me. A more blind person could read a braille. I can follow directions. I can help other people. And I imagine my dog could just lead everyone to safety from the downed plane. So I kind of thought, and I said to the airline desk person, I said, "That's discriminatory. I can help other people in all this." And she eventually let me have the seat. I got on the plane, but they wouldn't let me sit in it. And eventually I was told there that my dog would block the aisle because this particular bulkhead was an exit row, and the flight attendant on the plane said, "You can sit anywhere else. Please take another seat. You can have two seats. You can have a whole row." It was a Saturday night. The plane was empty. And I gradually realized that in the future I needed to say, I would like to reserve a bulkhead row seat if possible, but I have to make sure it's not an exit row. So this has been somewhat of a learning process, but also how do you deal with all these people?
There's also a freedom that you can have with Tila by your side that it's simply not possible otherwise. Part of the book is a story of taking a trip into New Mexico, and there is an early morning walk you described with Tila. I wonder, in fact, if you'd just tell us a little bit about that, because I get the feeling that it is a walk you simply wouldn't have been able to take in the last decade, at least, if you didn't have the guide dog.
Right, right, certainly. I have a morning walk in a desert town that I didn't know, where I didn't know my way around. I didn't know north, south, east, west streets. I'm doing the things that I was taught in guide dog school to do with my dog. Stop at the curbs, count the crossings, remember them, come back. So on this walk, I'm beginning to feel a little sad because I can't just be so totally free as I was before. And then I sort of pet the dog and I realize, I think about how this is my freedom now, this dog. Where we can go together, we go. And where we can't, we don't get. And I'm just very grateful for this companionship, even as lost as I may be in certain circumstances. And the walk turns out well because we do eventually, after getting lost, find our way back. And I feel very accomplished because it was hard for me. You know, I'm used to finding my way with visual clues. And as my vision decreases, I can do that less and less well. So I have to learn these other ways, counting, remembering, trying to identify some landmark that I'll be able to notice again.
What do you anticipate now about the ways in which your vision will change? Do you think that there is a different world waiting for you?
That's a good question. I think my vision, given my eye condition, it just gradually worsens. So it's not something that I would expect to be totally dramatic, that all of a sudden I go to total darkness. But it does gradually get darker and gradually have more of these imperfections. But it also poses certain delights. I can rest and be more comfortable in the greater darkness because I don't have to strain to see, and I can just move more fully as a blind person. I'm often moving in this shadowy in-between world in which things are neither black nor white, totally there, totally not. And somehow I think that in general, this split between sighted and blind, black and white, is a little deceptive. You know, sighted people are partly blind. Blind people are partly sighted. And I don't just mean visual sight, but how we see, how we know. And I'm trying to acknowledge the broad range of what vision may be.
Susan Krieger is the author of Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision, with a guide dog by my side.
In the beginning. Oh, long before that. When light was deciding who should be in and who should be out of spectrum, yellow was in trouble. Even then. Seems that green, you know how green can be, didn't want yellow in. Some silly primal envy, I suppose, but for whatever cause, the effect was bad on yellow and caused yellow to weep yellow tears for several eternals before there were years, until blue heard what was up between green and yellow, and took Green aside for a serious talk, in which Blue pointed out that if Yellow and Blue were to get together, not that they would, but if they did, a gentle threat, they could make their own green. Oh, said Green with some understanding. Naturally, by a sudden change of hue, Green saw the light and Yellow got in. Worked out fine. Yellow got lemons and Green got limes.
That's Ken Nordine with his jazz poem, Yellow. Now, it may seem odd to create music out of color, but some people really do see blue or yellow when they hear music, or see a color when they think of a certain number or letter. Others actually feel the flavor of food on their fingers. They have what's called synesthesia, a neurological condition which causes one sense to cross paths with another. It used to be considered an extremely rare condition. Today, scientists believe synesthesia affects an estimated 4% of the population. David Eagleman is a neurologist at the cutting edge of synesthesia research, and he's the co-author of the book Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia. And Strain Champs asked him to describe the condition.
Synesthesia can take a lot of different forms. Could you start maybe by giving us a sense of the range of experiences that people have?
Yeah, so there are something like 150 different recorded forms of synesthesia. It can be a mixture of the senses in any way that you can imagine. So, for example, some people will hear music and it causes them to see colors. And other people will hear a name and it will put a taste in their mouth. Other people, they'll taste something and it will make them feel like there's something being felt on their fingertips.
So for some people, you know, the color 3 is blue and the color 4 is purple?
That's right. It's probably the most common form of synesthesia. Things like numbers and letters will trigger color experiences. So Wednesday will be indigo blue and February will be yellow and so on. And for each synesthete, of course, it's different. They have a unique palette of associations that they make.
And so that's one of the more common forms, letters or numbers that have colors, but there are others. Your co-author discovered one case of synesthesia at a dinner party?
That's right. The chef at the dinner party, the host of the dinner party who was cooking the food, he said, oh, the chicken is not quite ready. It's not pointy enough. And so Richard Cytowick, my co-author, said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, you know, when I taste things, there's a certain feeling on my fingertips that I get. And I know when the chicken is ready because of the way it feels on my fingertips when I taste some of it. And that's what's happening in synesthesia, is that different areas of the brain are talking with one another in ways that they don't in a normal brain.
Hmm. What's the most unusual case of synesthesia you've ever run across?
One subject that I've studied in detail is a musician, and she has extraordinarily rich synesthesia where for every pitch, for every chord, for every instrument timbre, she experiences shapes and colors and textures. And she also feels as though her body is leaping or moving or sliding or falling when there are different key changes, for example.
It sounds like going through life on acid.
Well, the interesting part is that synesthetes accept the reality that's presented to them exactly the way that we all do. There's nothing interesting or unusual to them about it. For example, imagine if a colorblind person said to you, my gosh, everywhere you look, you see colors. That must be like being on acid. You would say, oh, well, actually, no, that's just what I take to be reality out there.
Do scientists understand what causes synesthesia? I mean, is there a gene that triggers mixed perceptions?
Well, I'm happy to say we've been making tremendous progress just in the last few years. It turns out synesthesia is heritable. And if you are in a family with synesthetes, if your parents are synesthetes, then you've got a pretty good chance of being synesthetic yourself. So what we've been doing is collecting up large families with synesthesia. And essentially what you do is you look at how the synesthesia marches through the family tree and look at what genetic changes have that same pattern. And so we're almost there now. We're probably just a few months away from pulling the first gene for synesthesia.
Well, speaking of synesthesia running in families, I noticed the afterword to your book is written by Dmitry Nabokov. That's the son of the famous Russian writer Vladimir Nabokov, right?
That's right. So it turns out that Vladimir Nabokov had synesthesia and wrote about it. You know, he had grown up reading Cyrillic, and then when he moved to the United States, he was reading our alphabet, and his colors transferred, and so he had synesthesia in both alphabets, and he really appreciated it and loved the colors that were involved. So it turns out Vladimir Nabokov's wife was also synesthetic, and their son, Dmitry, is also synesthetic.
But I'm just wondering what this would be like for a writer, somebody who's trying to create beauty out of words and who's lucky enough to have this particular neurological gift, we can call it, that gives them an added layer of sense perception that they can play with. So I'm wondering if Nabokov, you know, used his synesthesia in his writing, if it affected his writing.
Well, it's a very interesting question. The funny part about it is the colors that a synesthete will associate with different letters are idiosyncratic. They're just meaningful for him. And as a result, any sort of beauty that he injects into the language that way wouldn't be transmissible to other people. Nonetheless, one can always enjoy inside jokes. And so Nabokov, it turned out, was a lepidopterist. He loved butterflies. And so one of his favorite butterflies happened to have yellow wings and a black body. So if you look at it, it's yellow, black, yellow. Well, it just so happens that for him, the letter A was yellow and D was black. So he loved the name Ada, A-D-A, because that was yellow, black, yellow in the same way as his favorite butterfly. So one of his novels, he entitled Ada.
Right.
So that's an example of him using his synesthesia in his language. But again, it's just an inside joke. No one else would really get it.
Just a personal joke. Wow. That's right. That's just fascinating. Now, Nabokov is just one of, there have been many famous artists, writers, and musicians who've been synesthetes. We should talk about some of the others. Didn't the Russian painter Kandinsky have, well, an especially acute case of synesthesia?
That's right. Kandinsky, when he would hear music, would see shapes and colors and textures. So he would blast his phonograph and stand in front of his canvas and essentially paint what he was seeing. So if you can imagine a Kandinsky, that was for him music. And again, it only made sense to him exactly what that music sounded like and how it looked. But nonetheless, for the rest of us, that makes a beautiful painting. It makes a very unusual sort of sights and shapes and textures all put together. That was his internal experience.
Doesn't that make you think that you should really only look at Kandinsky's paintings if you have the music there as well? Has anybody ever exhibited them that way?
Well, that is a great idea. I don't know if anyone has exhibited it that way, but they should, certainly. This is an interesting point, though, because we have several idioms in our language that almost certainly were given to us by synesthetes. So when you talk about somebody having a loud shirt or a sweet personality or smooth jazz or sharp cheese, things like this, those were almost certainly expressions that were introduced by synesthetes, and yet they stick in the language because they sort of make sense. We sort of get it, even though we might not be synesthetic ourselves.
Well, do you wonder whether there's a kind of low-level synesthesia that perhaps we all have, or perhaps a great many people have?
Well, it does appear that there are certain connections across the senses that everybody seems to share, although at an unconscious level for most of us. So, for example, if I were to take a piano keyboard and hit the high note, ding, 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 and then I hit the low note, ding, 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 and I ask you, which one of those is brighter, what would you say?
The top one.
Okay, and if I were to say which one is bigger, what would you say?
The bottom one.
Well, that's what everybody would say. And that's really weird because all I'm doing is playing a note and you're answering questions about luminance and size. So what this suggests is that in everybody's brain, there are these connections across the senses where it just seems sort of natural to us that a high note would kind of be small and bright and a low note would be big and darker. And what that must represent is that there's cross-wiring between our hearing and our sight in all brains.
Well, we should end by talking about one piece of art created by a synesthete that we can actually listen to. So Olivier Messiaen was one of several famous composers who had colored hearing. How did he describe it?
When Messiaen would compose, he would talk about, for example, a blue-orange cascade of chords. To him, that made sense that when the music was moving in a particular direction, there was real color to it. So he really worked to have that beauty that he saw as part of the music. And when he described it in his diary and so on, he would describe the colors as well as the music.
For example, there's a piece you refer to, a 1977 symphony he wrote, Au Canyon des Étoiles, From the Canyons to the Stars, which was inspired by the red rocks of Bryce Canyon. Anybody who's ever seen Bryce or pictures of Bryce knows the rocks are this gorgeous red-orange color. Is that mostly what you hear in this piece, or are there other colors as well?
To Messiaen, when he wrote this music, it recaptured that color for him, that experience for him. It's not necessarily the case that any of us would have that physical color experience the way he did, but we can appreciate it adds something to us to listen to it and know that when he heard this music, he experienced those red colors.
Music from Messiaen's From the Canyons to the Stars, inspired by the red rocks of Bryce Canyon. And Strange Champs talked with David Eagleman, who directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor's College of Medicine. Eagleman's the co-author with Richard Cytoic of the book Wednesday is Indigo Blue. One of the literary world's most famous synesthetes was Russian novelist Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote about his colored hearing. Here's an excerpt from his autobiography, Speak Memory. Perhaps hearing is not quite accurate, since the color sensation seems to be produced by the very act of my orally forming a given letter, while I imagine its outline. The long A of the English alphabet has for me the tint of weathered wood, but a French A evokes polished ebony. This black group includes hard G, G, vulcanized rubber, and R, a sooty rag being ripped. Oatmeal, N, noodle limp L, and the ivory-backed hand mirror of O take care of the whites. I'm puzzled by my French on, which I see as the brimming tension surface of alcohol in a small glass. Passing on to the blue group, there is steely X, thundercloud Z, and huckleberry K. Such a subtle interaction exists between sound and shape. I see Q as browner than K, while S is not the light blue of C, but a curious mixture of azure and mother of pearl. The confessions of a synesthete must sound tedious and pretentious to those who are protected from such leakings and drafts by more solid walls than mine are. To my mother, though, this all seemed quite normal. The matter came up one day in my 7th year, as I was using a heap of old alphabet blocks to build a tower. I casually remarked to her that their colors were all wrong. We discovered then that some of her letters had the same tint as mine, and that besides, she was optically affected by musical notes. These evoked no chromatisms in me whatsoever. Music, I regret to say, affects me merely as an arbitrary succession of more or less irritating sounds. An excerpt from Vladimir Nabokov's autobiography, Speak Memory. Coming up, the story of how Chuck Close became a portrait painter, even though he has face blindness. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I do believe that painting is the most magical of the mediums because it transcends its physical reality. You have colored dirt and you dip this stick with hairs glued on the end of it and rub it around in that colored dirt and smear it on some cloth that's wrapped around some wooden sticks. It makes space where there was no space, and it can punch a hole in the wall. A painting can make you cry, and you're just looking at colored dirt smeared on a flat surface.
It's Chuck Close, a painter famous for his huge canvases and his uncanny ability to portray his subjects with almost photographic realism. What may be most remarkable is that Close ever became a portrait painter because he has a neurological condition that prevents him from recognizing people's faces. He's also partially paralyzed, having suffered a spinal artery collapse in 1988. Today, Chuck Close is in his early 70s, still painting, with brushes strapped to his hand, and now the subject of a biography by his friend Christopher Finch. Close and Finch recently sat down with Steve Paulson to talk about Close's painting career, going back to his grad school days in the mid-60s, when the talk among art critics was that painting was dead. Chuck Close.
If you were stupid enough to be a painter, you wouldn't want to be a figurative painter, and then the stupidest thing of all to do would be to do portraits. Clement Greenberg, the dominant critic at the time, said, there's only one thing that can't be done anymore, and that's paint a portrait. And I thought, oh, well, if Clement Greenberg says you can't make one, then that looks like a pretty good idea to me, and I'm not going to have a lot of competition. I'll have the whole area to myself. And it definitely did appeal to me to do something which was sort of perverse. It was very surprising, don't you think, Chris?
Well, it certainly surprised me when I walked into your studio that first visit, because there was big self-portrait, the one that's now in the Walker. Is it 21 or 28 foot nude?
22.
Boy, did those surprise me. This was not what I was expecting to see. And I think it surprised the entire art world. There were people who were those paintings at the time seemed almost transgressive, as though Chuck had done something terrible.
And to some degree, I think they still do look transgressive. And yet, if we talk about representational art and painting the human body, the human face, that's as old as it gets in painting, isn't it?
Well, it is, but the scale was different. Nobody had really painted anything that large to be seen from close to.
The thing that I think made it perhaps so shocking was that you weren't sure whether they were photographs, whether they were handmade, so you had to go up and look at them. And it was a warts and all view. I mean, you don't see big images of movie stars or something that haven't been, you know, corrected within an inch of their lives and all the zits and crow's feet and everything erased.
Hmm. So size has always mattered to you. The fact that you're painting on such an enormous scale, is it just because, I don't know, it hits you over the head?
I always said the bigger they are, the longer they take to walk by, and therefore the harder they are to ignore. But I always like extremes, make little teeny things or really big. You know, the thing that I hated was practicality. You know, when I was teaching in the university, everyone made art. We called it station wagon art. They didn't make anything too big because it wouldn't fit in their station wagon. That kind of practicality begins to make for a numbing sameness in all the work. And really, scale is a lot about the way we experience something. If we can't see it readily as a whole, you're forced to scan it, and your eyes dart across it and move around it. You know, I wanted to knock people's socks off. I didn't care whether they loved them or they hated them, but I didn't want them to leave the exhibition and say, oh, was there a Chuck Close in that show? You're damn well going to know there was one there, and then you can decide whether you like it or not.
Hmm. Now, you have a really interesting way of creating a painting, and very elaborate from what I've read. Almost all of your work uses a grid as the underlying structure as you're creating the image. You start by taking a photograph, and then you turn that photograph into a painting. Can you explain this process?
Yeah, but first, maybe why the photograph? And that comes from the fact that my learning disabilities, which are ordinarily considered to be problems just to be overcome, really drove me to do what I'm doing today. And one of them is face blindness, or as Chris will tell you,
prosopagnosia,
which is an inability to recognize faces.
This is actually a neurological condition you have. You cannot recognize faces, which is fascinating when you think that what you do is you paint human faces.
But when I flatten them out, I have near photographic memory for anything that's flat. So it makes perfect sense that I work from a flat subject, that is a photograph, rather than painting from a live human being.
Well, can you explain how you use your system of grids? I mean, how you work on a tiny little piece of the painting and then you move on to the next piece. How do you go about doing that?
Well, another part of my learned disability is that I'm overwhelmed by the whole, so breaking it down into lots of little pieces. So I'm so plagued with indecision, I can't order in a restaurant. And then I always wish I had ordered what you ordered. But when I break things down into small enough bite-sized chunks, I'm able to make a decision. So once I've got it broken down in a grid, I have a choice as to what systems I'm going to use. Now, I might ink up my fingers and put fingerprints in those grids, or I might take wet pulp and push that into the squares, or do diagonal lines, or scribble in each square, or paint 5 or 6 or 7 colors as sort of donut shapes or lozenge shapes or hot dog shapes. I know where I'm going. I don't know how I'm going to go there.
But the thing that's so remarkable is that the painting is totally different if you're way up close. I mean, you see those painterly techniques you've been talking about. You're playing with color and light. And then when you step way back, it looks almost like a photograph. I mean, this incredible realism. I mean, it's somehow having both those qualities within the same image is remarkable.
You know, actually, I feel that most great art, let's say since the beginning of the 20th century, has played with that tension between figuration and non-figuration. I mean, look at a cubist painting, it can be almost abstract, and yet you see there's a violin or a guitar and the front page of Le Monde. Chuck's just found a new way of doing it.
I can only imagine that this whole process must be incredibly time-consuming, especially if you're creating a canvas that's 9 feet high or something like that. How long does it take you to complete one painting?
Well, it depends upon the kind of painting. There were paintings that took more than a year to make a single painting. There were several of those that took 12 or 14 months. The ones that I'm doing now take 3 or 4 months. So I do about 3 paintings a year.
Now, much has been made of what happened to you in 1988 when you were 48 years old. You suffered a spinal artery collapse, which left you paralyzed from the neck down. Later, you were able to regain some movement, which allowed you to continue painting. When you look back on your career, when you look back on your life, do you tend to draw a line between before 1988 and after?
To a certain extent, but frankly, I really can hardly remember life before the event, as I call it. And sometimes when I roll by a mirror, I'm shocked to see that I'm in a wheelchair, because I sit and look out at a world that's essentially unchanged. When people look at me, they see me in a wheelchair and they see somebody who's disabled. But that's not really how I see myself. You know, it's a good thing I wasn't a violinist or a pianist, because I would not have been able to get back to work. I thought that the two great fears of the artist were losing your eyesight and losing your hands, and I thought they were equally devastating. What I found out was losing the use of your hands is not nearly the obstacle to overcome, clearly the blindness would be, and that once I figured out how to strap brushes to my hands and get back to work, I don't think the work changed a great deal.
Even though I'm assuming your technique must be very different now that, I mean, you have the brush strapped to your hand. I'm guessing you don't have the same fine motor control that you once had.
Well, I can't draw easily because drawing requires wrist and finger movement. I don't have wrist and finger movement, but you do paint with pretty much your whole arm.
There were things you had to learn to get used to, like you loved to work with filbert brushes before, and then you weren't able to do that.
Yeah, I couldn't twist the brush.
Yeah. But there was a point in the hospital early on when Chuck didn't know if he ever would have the use of his hands back, when he said one day, "I'm going to spit the paint onto the canvas if necessary." And he was deadly serious about that.
I assume this must have been terrifying when this first happened. I mean, wondering whether you really could paint again.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, if you ever been in a really bad car crash and time slows down and your car is spinning around and you're not sure whether you're going to, you know, careen into the oncoming truck in the other lane, there's something rather, I don't know, almost calm about what's happening. And the experience was a lot less exciting or devastating or whatever than I thought. I just lay there. And I was zonked on steroids and hallucinating and all of that. But I spent 8 months in the hospital. I remember thinking at the time, well, now what am I going to do? I'll have to make work of a much more conceptual nature. I'll have other people execute it. There are so many artists today who don't make their own work. I mean, Damien Hirst or...
Jeff Koons and a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, and my great good friend Saul LeWitt, who had other people execute most of his work. And they still managed to have really a signature style. It worked, looked like theirs. So I was prepared to do that. I would have greatly missed the physicality of pushing paint around.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you describe this as essentially a problem that you then had to deal with. You're suggesting that limitations throughout your life have been very important to you as an artist. I mean, in some ways, you've thrived on overcoming limitations or working with limitations.
Well, limitations, you're not going to do this anymore, you're not going to do that anymore. And every time you decide not to do something, that focuses your attention on what is left and what you can do. And it's a way to move forward. It's a way to keep from having an artist block. I think that in general in society, we're way too involved in problem solving. Problem creation is a much more interesting thing to spend your energy on. If you can ask yourself an interesting enough question, no one else's answers will fit. And you'll have to be a different artist than you were the last time. And you'll have to come up with a personal and idiosyncratic answer to this personal and idiosyncratic question that you've given yourself, and you're doing it without worrying about how other people are solving this problem because nobody else is working on it.
That's Chuck Close, along with his biographer, Christopher Finch, talking with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Seeing and Perceiving, number 26A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.